Nagarjuna reminds us in Precious Garland that for our speech to be truthful, it's not sufficient just that what we say is factually accurate. It also necessitates that our motivation is one of kindness. So saying something that's factually accurate but with a nasty motivation is not telling the truth, according to Nagarjuna. So it's important to remember this, because our speech is quite powerful. Sometimes we just say, okay, I have to tell the truth and tell this person I can't stand them. But if we're saying it with anger, it's not the truth. So it's important to watch our words and watch the motivation for our words. And that means also watching our mind and the motivation we have for speaking. So always turning that towards one of compassion, one of kindness, in the long term. Even though sometimes what we say may not be pleasant to other people's ears, if we say it with a good motivation and it's factually accurate, in the long term, hopefully it will be helpful to the others. So again, with this long-term perspective, looking for the benefit of self and others, not only in this life, but in future lives and all the way up to awakening, then let's root our mind in bodhicitta and have that be our motivation for all that we do. So there were some questions by some people in the class that pertain kind of tangentially, thank you. So I thought I would offer those, speak about those first, because otherwise I have to write long emails. And hopefully what people are asking, other people also are curious about. So the first question was to go over, because I think it was last time we talked about Buddha and Arya-Buddha, and to do the comparison between them, and so to go over that. So that's mentioned in Precious Garland, in this commentary. So when we're talking about it, the two things are Buddha and Arya-Buddha. It's not the Buddha, okay? The Buddha is a historical figure, the founder or the one who set the wheel of Dharma turning in our Aryan. And we're not considering the two things that we're comparing don't include the Buddha, okay? The two things are Buddha and Arya-Buddha, okay? So, from Maitreya's Ornament for Clear Realization, Chapter 8, he speaks of this. So, Kenzo Rinpoche says, Buddha is an ultimate quality that has arisen from its cause, the fulfillment of the two collections. So, Buddha includes the four Buddha bodies. Okay, so the nature Dharmakaya, the wisdom Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, the Nirmanakaya, okay? So, and each of those four is Buddha. No, it doesn't say each of the four is a Buddha. We're not using a and the. It's just each of those four is Buddha. Okay, in general, a Buddha's hands, arms, and the 32 signs and so forth are Buddha because they are Buddha's physical qualities. Okay, so remember Buddha here is an ultimate quality that has arisen from its cause, the fulfillment of the two collections. So similarly, the 21 unpolluted wisdoms in the continuum of an Arya Buddha are Buddha. So something can be in the continuum of an Arya Buddha and be Buddha. Okay? Because an Arya Buddha is a person. Aryas are persons. So an Arya Buddha is also a person. Okay, so those 21 polluted wisdoms in the continuum, unpolluted wisdoms in the continuum of an Arya Buddha are Buddha, and they are the ripening result of having meditated for many eons on the unpolluted path. Okay? Then Arya Buddha refers to a person who is fully awakened. Okay, so an Arya Buddha is a person. Yeah. Now, the enjoyment body is a person, the emanation body is a person. So remember when it says body here, it doesn't mean physical body. It means body such as like a corpus, you know, or a collection, a body of knowledge. Okay, that's what body means. It doesn't mean physical body. Now, so that's quite important. Otherwise, you're going to get confused. So the enjoyment body is not a physical body. The enjoyment body is not form. The enjoyment body is an abstract composite because it's a person. Yeah, the Nirmanakaya, the emanation body, the form the Buddha appeared in when he manifested in our world, is not a physical body, it's a person. Okay, so those two bodies are Arya Buddhas. Okay. Now, not everything that is Buddha is Arya Buddha. Okay? For example, the nature truth body of an Arya Buddha is Buddha, but not an Arya Buddha, because it isn't a person. So even though we say the nature truth body of an Arya Buddha, okay, the nature truth body of an Arya Buddha is not an Arya Buddha because it's not a person. But it is Buddha because it is a quality that came as a result of developing the two collections. Okay? Likewise, the Buddha's physical characteristics, compassion and wisdom, they're all Buddha. But they're not Arya Buddhas because they're not persons, even though they exist in the continuum of Arya Buddhas. Okay. Shakyamuni Buddha, on the other hand, is both Buddha and an Arya Buddha because Shakyamuni Buddha is a person.
Is there anything in the continuum of an Arya Buddha that is not Buddha?
Well, what do you think?
I would think not. I would think everything within the continuum of an Arya Buddha is Buddha.
Yeah, I would think so too. Yeah. Anybody have any other ideas? Well, the wisdom would be Buddha. Now, is the emptiness Buddha? Well, the nature truth body is Buddha, and the nature truth body is an emptiness. Yeah. So it would have to be. So then the definition needs to be switched a little bit. Because it says Buddha is an ultimate quality that has arisen from its cause, but the emptiness of the Buddha's mind has not arisen from a cause. Okay, so maybe we need to check this definition. Okay. Or sometimes, you know, they stretch the definition of cause. Yeah. Yeah, especially when it comes to nirvana, because nirvana is a permanent phenomena. But like we see in the three principal aspects of the path, when it says the cause and effect of all phenomena in right. Yeah. So there it's talking about nirvana, which is permanent, but when it says cause and effect, it doesn't mean an actual effect, because the true cessation, you know, which is nirvana, is not an effect, but it arises due to other, no, it arises due to other factors. You can't say that something that's permanent arises due to causes. Yeah, it rises in dependence on something, but that doesn't mean that it's a caused phenomenon. Yeah.
If we stretch that, if the causes are the completed two collections, then the wisdom truth body arises in dependence on those completed two collections.
Yeah.
Fair enough, right?
In the sense that you don't have a Buddha's wisdom truth body unless you've fulfilled the two collections. Okay, then the next one. Apparently there was a big discussion in the car, you know, about how tantricas realize emptiness and selflessness, okay? So the thing is that selflessness is a permanent phenomena. It's an unconditioned phenomena, okay? And permanent and unconditioned phenomena, according to the Tao Tantrika, are conventional truths. And they are not perceived by direct perceivers. Because remember, Satantrika really elevates things. They elevate impermanent phenomena. Okay, because, and so impermanent phenomena for the Tao Tantrikas are ultimate truths. Okay, yeah, and they are known by direct perceivers, but conventional truths such as selflessness are not. So it's completely different than Prasangika. You have to not think like a Prasangika now. Okay, so the appearing object of a direct perceiver must be a specifically characterized phenomena. Remember, specifically characterized is equivalent to impermanent, ultimate truth, you know, all those things. So the appearing object of a direct perceiver must be a specifically characterized phenomena. So the subtle selflessness of persons. Yeah, and the Satantrikas do not assert a selflessness of phenomena. They only assert a selflessness of persons. Okay, so that subtle selflessness of persons is not the apprehended object of the uninterrupted path of the path of seeing. Okay, according to Prasangika, it is. According to Satantrika, it's not. Okay. So this is because the subtle selflessness of persons is, first of all, it's not a specifically characterized phenomena. And second, it's realized implicitly through explicit comprehension of the physical and mental aggregates that are devoid of a self of persons. So when somebody is meditating, you know, on the selfless, to realize the selflessness of persons, they're meditating on the aggregates. That's their object. And the aggregates are appearing to that direct perceiver. Okay? And they know the emptiness or the selflessness of those aggregates implicitly because it cannot appear explicitly because it's not because it's a permanent phenomena. Okay, so the object of an uninterrupted path, of the path of seeing or path of meditation, must be directly perceived. Yeah. It has to be, the object has to be directly perceived. So the object is the aggregates. Okay. What is directly perceived must be a specifically characterized phenomena, and thus are always impermanent phenomena. An emptiness is permanent, and it's not specifically characterized phenomena. It's a generally characterized phenomena. So it cannot be cognized directly by those uninterrupted paths. So a yogic direct perceiver, according to the Sao Tantrikas, doesn't explicitly cognize selflessness. It cognizes the aggregates as not qualified with such a self. Okay? So thus, a compounded phenomena, the aggregates, yeah, are directly cognized, and thereby the selflessness or the emptiness of a self person is implicitly realized. Okay? Because you're seeing the aggregates vividly, and you're seeing that the aggregates are not a self, and that there is no self in the aggregates. But you see that emptiness implicitly because you're seeing the aggregates explicitly. So in an explicit realization, the aspect of the object appears to consciousness, whereas in implicit realizations, the aspect of the object does not appear to that same consciousness. Okay? So the object is, and the explicit object that's directly perceived is the aggregates, but in an implicit realization, the aspect of the object, in this case, its lack of a self, does not appear to that same consciousness. It's known, you know, implicitly. So this is a big difference between the lower schools and the upper schools, because the upper schools assert that you can know emptiness, which is a negation, directly. You know, emptiness, which is a negation, which is a permanent phenomena, is known directly. According to the lower schools, the Vaivasikas and Sao Tantrikas, yeah, they aren't known directly. Yeah, they're conceptually imputed. They're really made up. You know, so explicitly, okay, means that the realization of or comprehension occurs through the object appearing to the awareness. Okay. So the basic rule is that any object explicitly understood must appear to that consciousness. But the selflessness does not appear to the consciousnesses directly, because what's appearing to them is just the aggregates. Okay? So here we have to differentiate between directly and explicitly. Directly means without a conceptual appearance. Explicitly means it manifestly appears. Okay, so slightly different meaning of those two words. So according to the Sao Tantrika, selflessness is not realized directly because it's a permanent phenomena. The aggregates are realized directly. Okay. The aggregates are cognized explicitly because they appear to consciousness. Okay, they are realized directly because they aren't realized through a conceptual appearance. But selflessness is cognized implicitly Because it doesn't appear to that consciousness. Why not? Because that consciousness is a direct perceiver, and here direct means without conceptual appearance. Okay. So it's quite different than Prasangika. Yeah? Vaibhasika wouldn't say that emptiness is our ultimate truth. Are the smallest particles that can't be divided any also permanent phenomena are ultimate truths for them? Okay. Because they divide their phenomena into five different categories, which I can never remember. Anyway, Satantrika here.
Often in the tenets text, it says it doesn't just say that the aggregates are realized, but the aggregates devoid of a self person. And so I wonder, is that the mixture of the explicit and implicit realization? Or is that something that's able to appear to that yogic direct perception, the aggregates devoid of a self?
Yeah, I think it's both, that the aggregates devoid of the self appear. The aggregates that are qualified by being devoid of a self. But the part, the devoid of the self part, is realized implicitly. Okay. So you can try meditating like a Satantrika and tell us what happens. I remember at one of the Mind and Life conferences, Sharon Salzberg was there, and His Holiness asked her, you know, is this how you meditate on selflessness like this? And she said, yes. And in Bhante Gunaratana's book, one of his mindfulness books, when I read it, it sounded like he was saying this as well. Yeah. So it's very interesting, you know, as you look at the tenet systems, how they regard permanent phenomena. Yeah. And it really is kind of radical when you think that permanent phenomena, most of which are negations. So there's nothing there to see. It's an absence. To say that those can be perceived directly. Yeah. You know, it's really kind of radical to say that. You can understand why, like the Svatantrikas would say, you know, it's perceived implicitly. Okay. We done with that? Clear as mud. There's another thing. What was it? We were studying with Jeffrey. Oh, when Jeffrey was talking about the meaning of dependent arising dawning as emptiness and the meaning of emptiness dawning as dependent arising, then one of the things that was being refuted was them knowing if you were perceiving a dependent arising, then saying that the emptiness was understood implicitly. Yeah, there was some kind of negation there. Or, you know, saying something about that. Anyway. Okay. Do you want to do something you understand? Did anybody think of any things that you want to compare? Did you do some comparisons in the last week?
How do the two compare? Studying Tibetan and studying the Dhamma.
Very good. Okay, who wants to do that? Why don't you do it? Okay.
So something that's both studying Tibetan and studying the Dhamma would be Venerable Lamasil and Venerable Damcho going to Bill McGee's Tibetan class with the motivation to study the Tibetan language, to internalize the Dhamma and help spread it to others, and with the ultimate goal of attaining Buddhahood to be of benefit.
Can you study a language and study Dharma? Does it happen at the same time?
Well, I said, how does it compare studying Dhamma? Studying Tibetan and maybe practicing the Dhamma.
No, I'm just being a little picky here, you know, because Would those two things happen in exactly the same moment? Yeah. So when you're learning, you know, what the preposition gyakikugikyagi means, that would be also studying the Dharma.
Yeah, certain terms. Yeah. Tibetan Dharmic terms.
Okay. Well, learning what the term means, you know, learning the definition of the term, is that studying the Dharma? Yeah, you would understand the term differently. What exactly is studying the Dharma? What constitutes studying the Dharma?
Yeah.
That's more... Yeah, that's the whole thing. Yeah, the first one. Sankhikajo, you had?
Yeah, once I was living in Nepal and following a Tibetan class, and we were using the 37 practices as the basis. Mm-hmm. So we were going through the text and, you know, translating it. And I also memorized it in Tibetan at one point. And I just found the meaning, you know, just became so incredibly rich and inspiring at the same time. I don't know if it's hard to say the exact same moment,
yeah.
You know, translating a certain line at the same moment, you get this Dharma understanding, but just that whole experience of studying.
I agree with you. And the two can happen in one session, but when you're learning the actual meaning of the words and translating the line, are you necessarily really thinking about the Dharma meaning of them? You know, or do you translate the line and then afterwards, as you're, you know, you wrote it down, then you pause and you think about it. You think it can happen at the same time? Yeah. Because it's usually emphasized, you know, get the words, get a good translation. Then you start thinking about the meaning. But it would be an interesting thing to watch in your own experience and see. You know, I mean, definitely in one sitting, when you're sitting there translating, you can have both of those. But would they happen at the same time? I'm not sure. Yeah?
No, yeah, you're right. Maybe it's the level. It happens for Bill McGee and Dr. Jeffrey Hopkins. It's like, right? Sometimes we talk to Bill about why he chose certain even formulations of grammar, and it takes us a while to understand, oh, he's trying to emphasize the Dharma instead of the individual teacher. You know, like he's making those choices already as he goes because of the way he understands the Dharma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can ask him this question. It would be interesting to see what he says. Yeah. Uh-huh.
But even Jeffrey, he said this so many times in our class. You know, the first thing we do is try and get the words right. We're not translating. We're just talking about English.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's getting that straight first and then understanding the meaning.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, you want to continue?
So should I do it on the basis of studying Tibetan and studying Dharma, or studying Tibetan and practicing Dharma? Because I can see that there's a different flavor.
No, do studying for
okay.
both of them. Okay.
Okay, so we've got something that's both.
Hmm?
We've got something that's both.
You would have to phrase it as a session.
Okay, so an example would be a session. A session in which... someone is studying the Tibetan language and also contemplating the meaning of what they're translating and applying it to their mind.
Yeah, it would need to really be, to compare it, it would need to be at the same time. So anyway, we'll leave a question mark if they can have it at the same time. And you check up as you're learning and then let us know.
I don't think they can occur in the same moment, not in my mind yet. It's looking at the words and then it's putting the pieces together.
Okay. Mm. Then do the other parts of it.
Okay, something that is studying Tibetan and not studying the Dharma would be going to Bill's grammar class and just learning what the different particles are with no reference to the Dharma at all. Something that is studying the Dharma but not studying Tibetan would be coming to Venerable Children's Approaching the Buddhist Path teaching, where she doesn't mention any Tibetan throughout the teaching. And something that is neither, I think, would be coming to one of your classes and paying no attention and just daydreaming.
Okay. Okay. Good. Somebody, did you think of one? Who else thought of one in the last week?
Told me to do this one. Compare the two, Venerable Samten at the Abbey and Venerable Hoho at the Abbey, at Travasti Abbey.
The subjects of Venerable Samten and Venerable Hoho.
The subjects, Venerable Samten at Travasti Abbey and Venerable Hoho at the Abbey, are different because of being phenomena that are diverse. The subject, Venerable Samten, well, let's just shorten this. The subject, Samten and Hoho, have all eight approaches of pervasion.
Have all what?
All eight approaches of pervasion, or doors or gates of pervasion.
Why?
Why?
Well, so you're saying they're mutually inclusive.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Sharp faculty. Whatever is Samten is necessarily Hoho. Whatever is Hoho is necessarily Samten. Whatever is not Hoho is necessarily not Samten. Whatever is not Samten is necessarily not Hoho. If there is a Samten, there is necessarily Hoho. If there is Hoho, there is necessarily Samten. If there is not Samten, there is necessarily not Hoho. If there is not Hoho, then there is necessarily not Samten.
I hear a lot of Hohos, but I don't hear many Samten.
You need to go back to that lady in Spokane Valley.
Why don't you agree?
Oh,
I don't agree because I can go to the supermarket and buy ho-hos, but they aren't something.
Shortened, it was Venerable Samten and Venerable Ho at Travasti Abbey.
You haven't heard of Venerable Ho Ho, huh? Oh, yeah. Please meet Venerable Ho Ho. Okay, anything else people want to compare? Yeah.
This one's more serious. Okay, the two things are persons on the Mahayana path of accumulation and persons who have directly realized emptiness. Mm. So there are four possibilities, including neither. Persons on the Mahayana path of accumulation? No, persons. Oh, I see. And two is persons who have directly realized emptiness. Okay, so there's an example of both. The subject, Harold. So Harold is somebody who formerly attained the hearer path of no more learning. He became an arhat. And then he has just entered the Mahayana path of accumulation.
You can sit down now. Oh. Yeah. Or do you want to?
I don't know. Just, I don't know if you want to write all those words. Yeah. He's a former arhat. He's someone who became an arhat. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess he's still an arhat, yeah. He didn't get... Yeah, he's a hearer arhat, and he just entered the Mahayana path of accumulation.
Uh-huh.
Saying he's not an arhat.
No longer a hearer arhat.
Because if you're in the Mahayana path, the only Mahayana arhat is a Buddha. So.
Right.
But yeah. He has directly realized emptiness. Yeah. That's definite. So do I have to go through all the... reasons?
Yeah.
Okay, so he's a person on the Mahayana path of accumulation because he has newly attained uncontrived bodhicitta, mm-hmm. and he is a person who's directly realized emptiness because he previously attained the hearer path of no more learning. Okay, then there's an example of someone who is on the Mahayana path of accumulation but has not realized emptiness. Okay, so the subject Martha... who is definite in the Mahayana lineage and has just generated uncontrived bodhicitta. So she's on the Mahayana path of accumulation because she's just generated uncontrived bodhicitta. But she has not directly realized emptiness because she's not yet attained the path of seeing of any of the three vehicles. Okay, then someone who has directly realized emptiness but is not on the Mahayana path of accumulation. So the subject, Gabriella, who has just attained the Mahayana path of seeing. So she has directly realized emptiness because she's attained the Mahayana path of seeing. And she's not on the Mahayana path of accumulation because she's on the Mahayana path of seeing. Then an example of neither is a subject, Sanghikado. So Sanghikado is not someone who's on the Mahayana path of accumulation because she's not attained uncontrived bodhicitta, and she's also not somebody who's directly realized emptiness because she's not yet entered any path.
Okay, good. Yeah, this kind of thing is quite helpful for making, you know, understanding the paths and grounds and knowing who's doing what to really compare them like this.
Yeah. I had a question about Harold. Mm-hmm. So he has already realized emptiness. Wouldn't he quickly progress to the path of seeing?
No.
No.
The Mahayana path of seeing.
Yeah.
No. Because he's very familiar with the realization of emptiness and abiding in that. And for him to get to the path of seeing requires accumulating merit for one countless great eon. But he spends a lot of time in meditation on emptiness. So it actually takes him longer to accumulate the merit to get to the path of seeing. Mahayana path of seeing than if he had directly entered the Mahayana path. So that's one of the reasons our teachers always encourage us to think about bodhicitta now and set that and plant lots of seeds of bodhicitta in our mind, because entering the Mahayana path directly, you progress to Buddhahood quicker than first becoming an arhat on the fundamental vehicle path and then entering the Mahayana path.
Yeah, I realize he would take a long time to get to Buddhahood because of not having enough merit, but isn't the demarcation of the path of seeing having realized emptiness?
Yeah, but to the Mahayana path of seeing, it's not just directly realizing emptiness. You have to have that whole accumulation of merit behind it, because the Mahayana path of seeing and the hearer path of seeing, they're going to be mutually exclusive. Okay, why are they mutually exclusive, Venerable Tarpa?
Let me see if I can remember the subjects. The Mahayana path vehicle?
No, Mahayana path of seeing.
Mahayana path of seeing and the hearer path of seeing are mutually exclusive because they are diverse and because there's not any person that would be both simultaneously. I don't think my reasoning is so great. Because in order to be in the, if you were on the Mahayana path of seeing, you wouldn't qualify for the hearer path of seeing.
Yeah.
You'd have bodhicitta and that would kick you right out.
Yeah. And if you were on the hearer path of seeing, you wouldn't qualify for the Mahayana path of seeing because you didn't have bodhicitta supporting your realization of emptiness.
Do you accumulate merit when you're in meditative equipoise on emptiness?
You accumulate merit, but it's not called the accumulation of merit or the collection of merit. That's the collection of wisdom.
It is a very virtuous activity.
Yes.
So you must be accumulating some merit, but you're not accumulating the same amount of merit as actively doing things in subsequent.
You're accumulating a different kind of merit.
Okay.
Yeah, the accumulating the collection of wisdom, not the collection of merit. So what?
Or the collection of merit and the collection of wisdom. How do they compare?
Okay. You want to do that one?
Let's go through the without deciding first. If without deciding first, we could just do the both and go through the four and then figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be nice to have some more knowledge about the two paths. I mean, I have rudimentary knowledge, not refined knowledge. But it seems to me that from when you're out of meditative equipoise and you're practicing generosity and seeing the circle of three, the three elements is empty. Are you accumulating the collection of merit or the collection of wisdom?
But if the ripening result is, one is the form body and one is the truth body, right?
Primarily.
Uh-huh, okay. That might prove they're mutually exclusive.
Yeah, so I don't know. What do you think? Anybody else have something they want to compare? Or should we start reading? Okay, so we're on thought consciousnesses and direct perceivers, right? Okay, so the most important distinction between consciousnesses to understand is between thought consciousnesses or conceptual ones and direct perceivers. So naturally, a person might think that this distinction parallels the one between mental consciousness and sense consciousnesses, that thought consciousnesses are equivalent to mental consciousnesses, and that direct perceivers are equivalent to sense consciousnesses. However, these parallels do not work. Okay, so compare, let's see why they don't work. Compare direct perceivers and sense consciousnesses. What are you going to have? Three possibilities? Okay, do it. What are they? You want to write up the two that we're comparing?
Direct perceivers and sense consciousnesses. One that is both is me seeing that gong on your table.
It's no, you seeing the gong on the table is a person.
Okay.
That's not a good example.
Okay, but the eye consciousness.
The eye consciousness. Seeing the color of the gong.
Seeing the color of the gong.
Gong.
There we go.
Okay.
And the eye consciousness seeing the color of the gong is a direct perceiver because it's not using a conceptual appearance. And it's a sense consciousness because it's the uncommon, empowering condition utilizing a form, not using the exact words. Giving you this result, I can't remember the exact way they give their definition for eye consciousness.
Yeah.
It's a
knower.
A knower, yeah. They all start with a knower. All the consciousness start with a knower. A knower, depending on a uncommon empowering condition, the eye sense power, and it's, observed object condition, a form.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the reason. Okay, that's both.
Uh-huh.
A visible form, yeah. One that is a direct perceiver, but not a sense consciousness, is a yogic direct perceiver directly realizing emptiness.
Not in Satantrika, it doesn't directly realize
emptiness. We're in Satantrika. Yeah. I don't think that way. Yeah. Okay, how about let's pick something easier.
We could be
a mental consciousness.
Yeah, so you have to say it's not a, you have to say, why is it a direct perceiver? We're still on seeking the example.
Yeah,
so
an example
would be
works,
a yogic direct perceiver knowing impermanence.
Yeah, that would be better because...
Yeah, you have to have a... You can't just say yogic direct perceiver in general because it's always got to be of some object. Yeah, knowing subtle impermanence.
Why? The reason is not established.
Because you're trying to think of something specific.
Right.
Yeah.
We often use categories.
Yeah, I guess you could say it's a direct perceiver because it's a yogic direct perceiver. No, it's good to be more specific. You could probably use yogic direct perceiver, but it's good to think of a specific consciousness, though. Yeah.
We have kind of done better when we had an actual subject. So
yeah. Okay, so why is it a direct perceiver?
Why is it a direct perceiver? It's a direct perceiver because it's a consciousness not relying on a conceptual appearance.
Uh-huh.
And it's a non-mistaken,
and it's
non-conceptual perceiver.
No, you,
huh? I got to get that, my
no,
list
that's,
of definitions.
That's good enough.
I know by the meaning, but they have actual definitions of these.
But why isn't it a sense consciousness?
Why isn't it a sense consciousness?
Why is it not a sense consciousness?
Why isn't it a sense consciousness? Because it's a mental consciousness.
Yeah.
Okay, we got through that part. Now the next one is...
Okay.
Okay, so we've got one that's direct perceiver. Now we need one that's a sense consciousness. And there's not one. That's why it's 3P.
Yeah.
Because the sense consciousness or the direct perceiver... Hold on. The sense consciousness are a subset of direct perceivers.
What about...
Oh, wait. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. There, it's a subset.
Some texts make it sound like a subset, but yeah, you're shaking your head. What?
Oh, yeah, that's true. It has, makes it four possibilities then.
Sense consciousnesses may be direct perceivers, but they are not always.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're right. So it's four possibilities without any. Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. What is a sense consciousness?
That's not a direct perceiver.
That's not a direct perceiver.
That would be an example of that would be a visual consciousness seeing blue snow on a distant mountain. It's a sense consciousness, but it's not a direct perceiver. Because it's...
Oh, because a direct perceiver has to be non-mistaken.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a wrong non-conceptual consciousness.
Yeah. So it wouldn't, it's a wrong non-conceptual...
Yep, that you...
But is it called a sense consciousness?
Yeah, it has a... Yeah. It's a sense consciousness with a... both its appearing object and its apprehended object or engaged object are mistaken in this system.
Okay.
You can go ahead about 20 pages and you'll find that.
Okay, so non-conceptual minds.
I'm not sure if you and I agree on this.
No, what I'm thinking is maybe, well, I'm just wondering how they divide it. You know, do they say that... Well, what was that thing before? Sense consciousness. I was thinking a better example would be the second, what are we at? This, something that's a sense consciousness, but not a direct perceiver. For Satyandrika, the second moment of an eye consciousness, apprehending blue. Oh, that's true. No, it's not a direct perceiver. It's not a valid direct perceiver. Yeah, that's right. Okay. But they categorize like seeing a because I remember I brought this up some weeks ago, you know, seeing a snow mountain, you know, a white snow mountain is blue, and people were saying no, it's not a direct perceiver because it's a wrong consciousness.
Right. It's a sense
but it's still a sense consciousness. Okay, so there are sense consciousnesses that are not direct perceivers.
Correct.
Yeah.
According to this text. So she's saying inattentive perceptions is another example. But my example was an eye consciousness seeing snow on a mountain is blue.
Yeah.
And then the one that is neither snow as blue on a distant mountain. Yeah. Is the color blue on a distant mountain. And then
something that's neither a sense consciousness nor a direct perceiver.
My memory of of these definitions. Inattentive also.
Yes. Okay. Then the other thing to compare here was a thought consciousness and a mental consciousness. Okay, because he was saying that it's very easy to think thought consciousnesses and mental consciousnesses are the same. So what are thought consciousness, what are these? How many? Yeah, I would say three too. So what's both a thought consciousness and a mental consciousness? Or thought. Yeah, thought means thought consciousness. What's both? She said thinking about ice cream. Okay. Then what is a, what's the first one? a thought consciousness, but not a mental consciousness. There's nothing. What is a mental thought consciousness, but not a thought consciousness?
Yeah.
Knowing. Yeah, that one moment. And then what's neither a thought consciousness nor a mental consciousness? That's great. Okay. However, these parallels do not work. Though, of course, it is true that only a mental consciousness can be conceptual, Buddhists say that mental consciousnesses can be a direct perceiver as well. Also, the sense consciousnesses may be direct perceivers, but they are not always. So these two types of consciousnesses are real points of interest in the system, because the distinction between them reflects the distinction between ultimate truths and conventional truths, as well as other ways of dividing existence. Recall from chapter 9 that one of the divisions of existence is into ultimate truth, which is mutually inclusive with impermanent phenomena, and conventional truths, which is mutually inclusive with permanent phenomena. In the system of the Sutra school following reasoning, impermanent phenomena are raised up as ultimate truths, and permanent phenomena are simply flaky conventional truths. You know, they kind of shoo-shoo it, even though, you know, it includes selflessness. This distinction between the truths is based on the consciousnesses that are able to apprehend them. Every existent is a hidden phenomena, which means that it may be understood by a thought consciousness. This is according to Sautantrika, okay? It's not according to Prasangika, because they see it differently. Every existent is a hidden phenomena, which means that it may be understood by a thought consciousness, but only conventional truths must be understood by thought. Ultimate truths are ultimate because they may be understood by an ultimate consciousness, a direct perceiver that perceives its object exactly as it is. So that sounds so funny, you know, like the I consciousness perceives the object exactly as it is, you know. So that means that, yeah, well, that's why they say we don't have mistaken appearances when we have, you know, valid sense perceivers. Yeah. And then the Prasangikas say, well, then, yeah, you're seeing reality all the time. You know, when you look and see the walls, you're seeing reality. So then, what is reality, as they used to say, if you can see it with your senses? Yeah, it sounds very strange, doesn't it, after you've studied Prasangika. We can take thought consciousnesses to mean the same thing as a conceptual consciousness or thought or thinking consciousnesses. A conceptual consciousness is defined as a determinative knower that apprehends a sound generality and a meaning generality as suitable to be mixed. Yeah, you got it? Don't you love these definitions where you have to learn the meaning of every word except A? Yeah. So taking this, that now we're going to go into a huge thing about, you know, understanding this definition. Taking this definition point by point, first, a conceptual consciousness is a determinative knower. The meaning of determinative is that such a consciousness thinks this is such and such. This is, that is such and such. A conceptual consciousness determines that an object is such and such. Okay, so it's just something that's able to discern what the object is. Mm-hmm. Seems to me that sense consciousnesses would also be determinative knowers. A conceptual consciousness determines that an object is such and such. a sound generality, which might also be called a term generality, is a generalized conceptual image that you get based on the sound of the name or description of a thing without actually knowing the real meaning of the thing, like an impression of a person you get from just hearing the name or some comments about that person before you have met. Okay, so this is two different ways of having a sound generality, you know, and I've seen them, not, he couples them together, it could be either this or that, but I've also seen them one way and the other way. Okay, so it could be the sound of the name, you know, and you have no clue, like an ishkababble. Okay, so what is... You hear Ishkababa and you have a generalized conceptual meaning, image of it. What's your generalized conceptual meaning of Ishkababa? Yeah, she has a clear image of an Ishkababa. And what is it for you?
Kind of Turkish food.
So, we can see we have lots of sound generalities. Okay. So, that's one kind of sound generality. The other, it can be a description. Somebody tells you what something looks like. Okay. So, you know, there's this statue of a lady wearing a crown, holding a torch, and it's standing in the middle of the ocean, and people see it when they're coming to America. Yes. Yeah, so the image you get from hearing that description, okay, would be a sound generality. You don't know exactly what it is, but you're getting some kind of something from hearing the description. Okay.
Would that be if you didn't already know, had that statue in your mind?
Right. You know, you had no idea what the Statue of Liberty is. You just heard a description of, you know, why did they put the statue in the middle of the ocean?
The first time we're guided in a deity sadhana and we get the description of the Buddha, that's what's arising. A sound generality is appearing to the mind.
Well, now I would say you'd be getting a meaning generality, a conceptual appearance too, because it's... You know, it depends how good your visualization is. Yeah.
You've already seen a picture and then you hear a description.
You hear a description. Yeah, then I think it would be mixed. But here it's saying, okay, generalized conceptual image that you get based on the sound of the name or a description of a thing without actually knowing the real meaning of a thing. Like the impression of a person you get from just hearing the name or some comments about that person before you have met. So maybe it would be, yeah, you don't really know what a Buddha is, and you hear just a very general explanation. But it would seem to me that when you hear a very particular, explicit explanation, yeah, very detailed one, that maybe you would, that would be both of them being mixed. But it's true, the first time you do it, mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't really have a good idea of what in the world you're doing, do you?
Unless it's a talk in the room, but often it's not.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. If somebody said, okay, we're visualizing Chenrezig, so you visualize somebody with 11 heads and 1,000 arms, I mean, that could turn out looking many different ways, couldn't it? Yeah.
So is the conceptual consciousness dependent on language? Like you have to speak a language?
No, you don't have to speak a language because animals also have conceptual consciousnesses.
This one talks about a name, sound of the name, and then description, and both are words.
Yeah, but he's giving examples according to human beings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But for a baby, like a baby knows its mother before it knows the words mama. You mean bow wow?
When you teach a dog words, dog, you first say a word to a dog, they'll have a sound generality.
Right.
but they won't have a meaning generality with it. And then as you keep associating the word with the object, then mm-hmm. they'll be suitable to be mixed eventually.
Right, yeah. Okay. A meaning generality, or I say conceptual appearance, is a generalized conceptual image of something that you have previously met with. Okay. Although it can be a mixture of many different things together, many different qualities together, so you haven't necessarily met with the exact thing that you're having a conceptual appearance of. For example, when someone says car or dog or ice cream, something appears to your mind because you know what these terms refer to. You know their meanings. That image appearing to your mind is a meaning generality or conceptual appearance. One way to understand these generalized mental images is, okay, if someone says the word ocean to you without your knowing its meaning, the image generated at that time is a sound generality, a mere reverberation of the sound ocean. So it doesn't even have to be a mental picture. It can just be the sound of the word, okay? When someone says the word ocean and you know its meaning, the image that appears to your mind is a conceptual appearance or meaning generality. Although not the actual object, the image appears to be that object. Okay. Now, I've heard some people say it's not so good to use the word image when we're talking about conceptual appearances, because that kind of implies that it has to be a visual image in your mind. And it could be a hearing image. You imagine what something sounds like, what something smells like, what something tastes like, what something feels like. So don't think that, you know, when we say conceptual appearance, that it has to be something visual to you. So when you know the meaning generality is what appears to your conceptual awareness. For instance, the conceptual consciousness thinking about a table understands its object through the appearance of a conceptual appearance or meaning generality of a table. Now, I wonder, you know, here's an example. For us, do you mostly have a visual image when you think of a table? Yeah, I wonder somebody who's blind, they might have a tactile image of what a table is. Or when you say, you know, Madison Avenue, is it a street? Yeah, a big street, yeah. So somebody who's blind might have a sound image of what it sounds like, okay? Although there is not a definition of meaning generality itself, isn't that interesting? They're so particular about giving definitions to everything. And here's a major concept, and there's no definition. It's like one nature. No definition. We can construct definitions of specific meaning generalities. For instance, the meaning generality or conceptual appearance of a table is defined as that superimposed factor that appears like a table to the thought consciousness apprehending table, although it is not a table. Why are you laughing? Did I read it wrong? A superimposed factor that appears like a table to the thought consciousness apprehending table, although it is not a table. It's a fake table. Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. It's a fake table. When you know, you're sitting there imagining somebody you love so much, you know, what you're focused on is a fake. According to this system, we understand a thing like a table by the appearance of a superimposed factor, which is, this I love, which is the elimination of all that is not exactly identical with the table. Now, what, first of all, what is exactly identical with a table? Because there is no one table. Okay. But we it's the elimination of everything that's not exactly identical with a table. So we really don't know what a table is. I mean, because you could somebody could see a table and think four legs and a top. Somebody else could see a table and think three legs and a top. Some people could think a round table, some people squares, some people, you know, there's many different tables. So it's interesting, you know. We don't even know exactly what we're talking about. Imagine that. Okay, so it's the elimination of all that is not identical with the table. Now, I always hear, when I hear this, I go, how do you know? Because they say, and the next sentence says, thus, we understand a thing by a negative root, which is accomplished by eliminating all that is not other than what is understood by the term or thought. What appears to the thought consciousness, apprehending a table, is the elimination of non-table. That is, all that is not a table is eliminated, and thought understands what is rest, what is left. So I want to know, how do you know that that's how thought apprehends things? Takes what?
It seems like that would take a long time.
Yeah.
But it's also what science is saying.
They say it's the opposite of everything that isn't the object.
I remember in psychology class in college, that's what they taught. And I said, what?
That's what thought is.
Yeah, like identifying an object is a negation of everything that it's not.
So I want to know, how do you know that?
They must have some, I think they had studies, you know, because you need some kind of evidence.
Yeah, could you look it up and see,
sure.
You know, yeah. how they figure that out?
And Klein gets into this big time in that book, Knowledge and Liberation.
Oh, uh-huh.
It's really worth reading, and it's hard to read. But at the very end part, she gets into this. And I'll just, to give you my understanding, what came to my mind that really helped me with this is, she at the very end of that book, they explain things related to language and this and that. And it really made me think of, if I imagine a infant who's learning to identify things on a table,
mm-hmm.
This is how I think of this now. It's like, you know, when we're teaching kids colors, here's orange, here's this, here's a carrot, here's an apple. And so when you say to a little infant who's learning things, where's the apple? Then they're going to look at the carrot, not apple, you know, not, that's not an apple. You know, everything else on the table, if you have a mm-hmm. bunch of objects, and they're all going to get negated. And what's going to be left is the thing that they have a picture in their mind. Because she explained in this book how these are formed. And it was complicated, but it was really worth going through. And it gave you the idea, it really made more sense than I ever had before. Mm. And it made me really think of how an infant might learn. You know, because if you had a whole bunch of stuff on a table and you're trying to find the apple, you'd look at all these things and you say, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that. You know what I mean? So you actually have to negate all those other things to know that they're to find the apple. That's just how I had to think of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could do that pretty quickly. I mean, look in this room. When you have anyway, it works for me.
It'd be interesting to read it. Yeah. Would somebody like to read this and then give us a more elaborate summary? Okay. Yeah, because I've always been curious. How do you know that that's how thought is formed? Yeah, because it would happen so quickly in your own mind that how do you even know what's going on?
Right. I remember reading an article by Venerable Christine Scarda, who was a philosopher and a neuroscientist before she ordained, and she was describing this phenomena. Unfortunately, at the time, I couldn't really take it all in, but she was talking about it from a scientific point of view and saying how
they have been able to show in scientific studies that the mind breaks things down, and then the scientists were always wondering, when do they put them back together again? And they don't. And this was perplexing for them. So I'll see if I can find that article.
Yeah. Okay. Through the appearance, is that where we are? Through the appearance of a meaning generality of a table, a thought consciousness understands a table. Thus, thought understands its object in a general way, for the internal image represents whatever it is you understand by the term table. Okay, so we're all going to have a different internal image. It is not a specific table, but an image of a table in general, since what appears to a thought consciousness is a permanent phenomena. Permanent phenomena are called generally characterized phenomena. Their characters are known only in a general way by an imputing thought consciousness. And since they depend on such imputation by thought, they are not established from their own side, says the Satantrikas. There is no way to realize a permanent or generally characterized phenomena by way of its own specific entity. And so this is also when they're talking about selflessness. Yeah? The appearance of that internal mental image prevents thought from perceiving the actual impermanent ultimate truth that is a table. Rather, thought focuses on the static generalized image of a table in and of itself, understanding the abstract rather than the specific object. Although the image may not last forever, for the time it endures, it is a static, unchanging, permanent phenomena, as are all appearing objects of conceptuality. Okay, so it does not exist from its own side, right? It said that? Yeah. Okay. So you can see, like when we do visualizations, you can see that the mental image changes. You know, the Buddha's there, and then he starts radiating light when you remember that he's radiating light. When you've forgotten that he's radiating light, he isn't radiating any. Yeah. Or, you know, Vajrasattva's on the crown of your head, and, you know, he's just sitting there. And then after a while, he starts, you know, the nectar starts. So the image changes, but each image you have is a permanent phenomena. And one image does not cause the next image. And when we were in Dharamsala this last time, I asked one of the Geshe's this. And his reason was, why is it permanent? Is he said, okay, you think of something, and until you have some more experience with that object, your image of it remains the same. Yeah, so he was saying that's why it's permanent. That doesn't quite satisfy me, because something can look the same but not be, you know, I mean, the book looks the same from one moment to the next, but it's not something permanent.
Another criteria, though, is impermanent phenomena are created from causes and conditions. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a whole process of causes and conditions coming together, and then this impermanent phenomena arising from that. So that's not the case with mental images. I mean, there are no phenomena coming together and then producing this mental image.
Yeah, but another way of looking at it, it feels like there's your mind, and then you contact other objects, and then you put it together and you come up with an image.
But the image itself, I mean, your mind is doing this activity, but
yeah,
the image itself, is that really coming into existence from all yeah. these causes and conditions?
To me, it actually, you know, it seems to me like we're creating the image. Yeah.
It's definitely dependent on the mind.
Yeah.
It wouldn't exist
without the mind.
But, you know, does the mind actually create it?
Yeah.
In the same way that we create a table from, you know, putting together pieces of wood, we create a cake from flour and so on. So how does the mind create?
Well, to me, that would make as much sense as saying it's the opposite of everything the object isn't. Yeah. Jeffrey, when he was talking about it, because he's not so sure about this one either, and what was his reason when he would... Oh, he was saying, because these images have effects. When you visualize the Buddha, what you visualize has an effect on your mind. So he was saying, you know, it seems like they're causal phenomena. They're made and they have effects. And he was saying, he always says that the Tibetans kind of cheated themselves out of having a philosophy about how tantric visualizations work by saying that all these images are permanent. Yeah, does he explain that more? Do you remember what he said when he talked about this?
What I remember that he also said was that it was just such a strange phenomenon that a school that was so detailed in all of these ways, on one hand, when you get into Tantra, they just drop it and don't look any further or define it any further.
Yeah.
That kind of mind.
Yeah, it's interesting that there's not a lot of debate and explanation about what it is that you're visualizing, and how does a visualized image become the actual deity?
So then the theory would be that if they're permanent, that when you're imagining all the nectars flowing through you and things, that it's like a film where it's just static images just running all together.
That's what it seems like. Just, one static image after another static image, which again feels very strange, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But... you know me, I'm the doubter. Me and Satyantra, because, you know, we have a special relationship. Yeah.
I was just wondering if there's a differentiation between the images in dreams and the images in waking life.
Yeah. Yeah, the images in waking life that from thought consciousnesses, they're permanent. Dream forms are impermanent phenomena that are known by direct mental perceivers. Yeah, they're forms for mental consciousnesses.
When we see a sense object and then for a moment we have a mental consciousness that we never remember, that's a direct perceiver.
Right.
That dream mental consciousness, is that a direct perceiver?
I think so, because they talk about dream objects. And dream objects are phenomena sources.
It's in the same category as non-conceptual consciousnesses, like eye consciousness seeing two moons. Dream consciousnesses are not the image itself, but the consciousness. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of a dream consciousness, not the dream image itself.
That's Rinpoche's book, Mind in Tibetan Buddhism. My understanding is there's different opinions, different points of view, if dream consciousness is a direct perceiver or a conceptual mind.
Yeah.
So that would then have an effect on what the objects are, if they're meaning generalities or form.
Right.
Anyway, there's different views.
Yeah. Actually, in meditation on emptiness, you know, there are forms for mental consciousnesses. Anyway, variety of opinions. We don't know what anything really is. Okay, shall we stop here? Okay, so we're stopping with please appreciate that meaning generalities are asserted to be permanent. So you see, he knew that that people like me are in the audience who are going to say, I don't know about this. Okay, should we read the next paragraph? Okay, so please appreciate that meaning generalities are asserted to be permanent. This might seem surprising. It would certainly seem that since these things come into existence after experiences and are based on those experiences, they are created and are therefore impermanent. Right. For instance, we come to learn the meaning of dog in dependence upon seeing a dog and being taught its name. Yes. In this way, a meaning generality of dog comes into existence. You got it. The internal image may be a mental snapshot of a specific dog frozen in time, and that image now serves as an elimination of all that is not that dog. I don't think so. Also, we can easily note that these internal images are not always the same ones, right? Just like the dog isn't the same. Once you have a new image of something, it is hard to recall the old one. However, I have caught myself with a new image for a person's name. Suppose that there has never been a big player in your life named Susan, though you had an image of a Susan that you went to school with. Then a new Susan becomes a big player in your life, and the image of her becomes what appears to you when you think of Susan, not the old one. Have you had an experience like that? I think we all have. If so, it would seem that the image for Susan had changed and therefore was impermanent. However, the thought here is that the image is permanent because it is an elimination of all that is not such and so. Recall the story of the room free of elephants. The room is impermanent. However, the absence of elephants in that room is permanent and static, not created, even if the room has been cleared of elephants. I agree. So the thought in regard to these internal images has to be that the internal image that is a meaning generality is not like the impermanent room free of elephants, but like the permanent absence of elephants. I don't know. Thus, the image is what appears in order to represent the exclusion of all that is other than what is being understood. Susan, a table, ice cream, and so forth. Also, the image is not a visual object, but a mental object, even if it appears like a visual object. Sometimes these internal images appear like sounds or tastes or tangible objects, but they can never be any of those things. This is why we cannot share them. There's lots of reasons why you can't share them. And this is why the definition says appears like a table to the thought consciousness apprehending table, although it is not a table. Yeah, but that doesn't mean it has to be permanent. Shall we finish this section? Finally, we're in the middle of the mystery plot. Finally, the above definition of a conceptual consciousness specifies that a thought apprehends a sound generality and a meaning generality as suitable to be mixed. So we're going back to the definition, and we're at the phrase of suitable to be mixed. A conceptual consciousness takes these generalities as suitable to be mixed, meaning that a person associates a sound, especially a term, with a meaning, that which the term refers to. They are merely suitable to be mixed because it is clear that a person does not always associate the meaning and the term. For example, when you forget what something means. For example, sometimes you don't know what to call such a thing, or sometimes you have never seen such a thing before. So in those instances, you know the object but not the name. It can also happen in the opposite way, so that you take cognizance of the meaning generality without mixing it with the sound generality. For example, some scholars say there are thought consciousnesses arisen from meditation, such as those realizing impermanence or selflessness, that are not apprehending a sound generality. Probably because you're not talking in the middle of your meditation. We'll just finish this, but we'll come back and go through it again. But thus, it is possible to have a thought taking cognizance of a sound generality without knowing the meaning. Like when you ask your friend about so-and-so whom you are interested in meeting, but now know only that person's name. And it is possible to know a meaning generality without knowing a sound generality. For example, presumably a cow knows the meaning of a salt lick, those big yellow blocks farmers put in the pasture for animals, but she would not know the name salt lick. And of course, it is suitable to mix the sound generality and the meaning generality when you know both the term and the meaning. If you look closely, you will see that some of your internal mental images are the words themselves. This does not happen with things like ice cream and dog and cat that you learn very early on, probably before you knew how to read. Wouldn't a mantra be a sound generality? Most mantras? Yeah. It's the term. Yeah. However, it seems to often happen with more abstract notions, such as economic inflation or sexism. It seems to me that with these sort of internal images, I get a snippet of television-style imagery, like an introduction that includes the words and some visual images that might be associated with inflation or sexism. Just watch, like you are playing a game, to see if you can catch them. Anyway, maybe they are not real. You figure it out. So we'll be aware of that. Yes.
If you're interested in meeting someone, wouldn't that presuppose you know some quality about them? Like his example about that only being a sound generality, but you're interested in meeting that person, that you only know the person's name. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Doesn't that?
Yeah, it sounds like you would already have some idea of what the person is if you want to meet them, which would mean that you would have a meaning generality. Okay. Yeah, but if you want to meet somebody?
To have a meaning generality, you would have to have an actual perception of the person, know what they look like. And
yeah, you don't think a description would be?
No, that's one of the things that gives rise to a sound.
So then when we visualize the Buddha, that wouldn't be a meaning generality, it would only be a sound generality.
We cannot meet the Buddha, but we can see pictures and statues of the Buddha. And
yeah.
I mean, Buddha's famous, so.
Yeah, well.
Most people have
some kind. Your friend that you've heard about. Maybe if you've seen a picture of that person, you might have a meaning generality. But if somebody described their qualities to you?
I don't know. My understanding is, for example, if you've never been to Rome, okay,
uh-huh.
You can hear descriptions of it. You can look at photos, maybe even, you know, movies about Rome. But I think, I don't know if you would have a meaning generality of Rome until you actually go there. And see it.
He specified in here that it has to be something that you've known. But then you could have a meaning generality of the photograph of Rome. I have a meaning generality of the photograph of the Colosseum. Bodhicitta is known by a conceptual consciousness. So that would mean bodhicitta is a primary mind, but what you're the sentient beings you're thinking of would be just a meaning generality of sentient beings. And the enlightenment that you're thinking of would be a sound generality of enlightenment and a meaning generality of numerous sentient beings. But a sound generality of all sentient beings, because you've never known all sentient beings. Sounds strange, doesn't it?
Referring to a meaning generality of a table, part of it says, appears like a table to the thought consciousness apprehending table, although it is not a table.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not a table, how can it be the elimination of all that is not table? If it's not table.
Interesting.
And it too would be eliminated. So all that does not appear like a table?
Yeah.
Or?
He has a good point. If it's the negative of everything that's not a table, wouldn't it be a table?
So it must be the elimination of everything that is not a thought generality of a table.
Okay, put this on the question list for Geshe Dadol. Okay, who's keeping our question list? Image that represents the elimination. Then what is the, can you see the elimination? The elimination would be the table.
I wonder if it's just simpler. If you have an image of a table in your mind, mm-hmm. right, you don't have an image of other things in your mind.
Not that you actively negated them. They just aren't there.
Yeah. I'll think about it. But not tonight.